done with in collaboration with Rachel Rosen, who is a student at NYU. So we published one paper. However, most of the part that I'll talk about today is work in progress. The punchline is that I'm going to try to consider theories in which there are charged scalars and charged fermions. So this is a general, very general class of theories in which you can have those types of fields. So typically, relativistic field theories are used, and most of us know that they are used to describe, you know, scattering processes and the production of particles, etc., etc. So it is applied to accelerator physics. But also there is a subfield of relativistic field theories in which one describes state of matter under some unusual conditions, such as high densities or high temperatures. And this is the part that I'll be using relativistic field theory for. And in particular, I'll be considering a state of matter in which you have charged scalars and charged fermions at high enough densities. And what I mean by high enough density is the densities between atomic densities, which are densities that are greater than atomic densities and less than nuclear densities. So if we very roughly think of distance scales, then we would assign one angstrom as a typical atomic scale and one Fermi as a typical nuclear scale, and there is a 5 orders of magnitude difference between those scales. So I'll be discussing physics between those two scales. Okay. And a simple model that I'll have is that there is a massive charge scalar, which I call phi, and then there are massive or massless, doesn't matter, massive charge fermions. For instance, one particular application would be this massive charge scalar could be a helium nuclei, and these charged electrons could be charged electrons. And I'll be considering matter at densities in which atoms don't form simply because all these particles are close to each other at distances which are shorter than the atomic distances, but still below the nuclear distances. Okay, so that's the type of the densities we'll be talking about. Now, the punchline of the talk, which I'll give you now, and then I'll describe in detail how it comes about, is the following. So I'll try to argue that there could be metastable, very long-lived states in which the spherical states, which are characterized by the following properties. So in the bulk of these states, there is a Bose-Einstein condensate of charge scalar phi, and the charge in the bulk is compensated by these fermions psi. So let's say these are minus and these guys are plus. So the bulk of this object is charge neutral. However, there is a surface charge which remains here. And I'm going to argue that this is a dynamical object that could be very long lived, metastable, but very long lived in a relativistic field theory containing just massive scalars and fermions that interact through electromagnetic interactions. Okay, so there are a bunch of questions at the moment: how this is stable, why this is stable, how it comes about, all that. So that's what I'll be discussing in detail. So that the plan of the work is this. So first, what I'll do is that I'll go into the limit when this is enormous. In other words, when this phase, the phase in which the condensate of scalars and fermions, it occupies the whole space. So I'm going to call it infinite volume limit. And then in that limit, I'll discuss small fluctuation on the background solution itself, how this is charge neutral and what's going on the surface solution. And then I'll also describe what are the small perturbations. Fields in that vacuum, just to make sure that there are no instabilities, etc. So after that, I'll go to the stability of these objects, and there are two types of stability one should understand, first of all, this is ordinary collapse or decay. So this is stability with respect to collapse or with respect to decay in the full space. That's one type of stability. And other type of stability could be just could be related to absorption or rather accretion and okay, so evaporation. Absorption from the surface, because surface can accrete something or emit something, and one needs to understand whether that's the object is stable or not. So finally, I'll come to the point where I include gravity in the picture. So this will be, if gravity is dominating in this case, the basic conclusion would be that this object would look something like, very similar to neutron stars. However, there may be some slight differences which I point out. And then there is a part of the work which is still under progress, which is that possible formation of these objects in cosmology, which we are asking ourselves basic questions. However, we don't have complete answers yet, so I'll just mention some of those issues. Okay, so let's start with the point one, that's infinite volume K. So this theory is very simple. So I'll just write here the Lagrangian. So this usual electrodynamics in which you have additional charge scalar field with the mass mh, and these are just ordinary fermions. So there is nothing fancy about it. For the purposes, for my purposes, it's convenient to go into the basis of fields where we express everything in terms of gauge invariant variable. For instance, the gauge field there is not observable object because you can change the gauge, etc. But in this theory, there are, of course, gauge invariant, or as in any theory, most of the theories, there are gauge invariant observables, which are physical and you cannot gauge remove it by transformations. So in particular, the useful variable that I'll be alluding to is this combination, A mu being the photon field, A mu is a photon field, and this D mu alpha is a phase of the charge scalar field. So both of them transform under gauge transformation, but B mu is gauge invariant. Okay. So then the Lagrangian you can rewrite as the field strength for B, and then there is the term which will be important for me, and that's just So let me explain all the terms. This is the same term as here, but I just did the shift, and because F mu is gauge invariant, it's not sensitive to that. Now this term and this term are coming from the kinetic term of phi, because you have covariant derivative, there is a coupling between the gauge field and the phi. So these are the two terms that you get if you rewrite in terms of p. And this is the ordinary mass term for this modulus of phi. And then L sub fermion is that Lagrangian in which you replace A by B.
So capital D is defined with A?
Capital D used to be defined by A, and I can here when I shift it, I'll get additional D mu alpha times fermion current. But okay, so but the point is this. So let's look at the mass term. Okay, so the scalar had ordinary mass, nothing. Nothing special. However, there is this term, and if by some physics the zeroth component of the gauge field, okay, acquires non-zero vacuum expectation value, then this term acts as a tachyonic mass for the scalar. Okay, so if V0 is non-zero, this is like a tachyon mass for the scalar. So that means that it would destabilize the scalar and make it condense. That's what it means. Okay, and the question is how you produce, of course, non-zero vacuum expectation value of P0, That's easy, because if you have fermions, or in other words, you have chemical potential for fermions, that is, if you have excess of fermions over anti-fermions, there is a non-zero charge density, so I'm going to call it J0. J0 is a fermion charge density. Sorry, fermion is a fermion number density, which if you multiply by coupling constant will be charge density. Okay, so the non-zero J0 gives you this B0, this electric field, and then electric field destabilizes your scalar and makes it to condense. Okay, so what I said in words is just a consistent solution of equations of motion that follow from here. And what I'm trying to do is to mimic this interior of this ball, which is spread now at infinite space, and there I assume approximately constant distribution of fermion number density, so that the solutions take very simple form. So the consistent solutions of the equations of motion are this. Okay, so because we have non-zero J0, the sigma acquires the VF, and the B0 is MH, and small g is a coupling constant, which for the most of the talk I'll be putting it to equal to 1, but we can always restore it. Okay. All right. So what is this phase? First of all,
could you explain where that?
Yeah, this is just a solution of equations of motion. Okay, let me parenthetically here, because
yeah, I'm just looking for
yes. So equations of motion are like this: F mu nu plus let me put b sorry g equals to 1. So and then you will have j nu. Okay, that's the equation of motion for gauge fields, because it's coupled to fermions. And equation for motion for the scalar is of course this box phi, that'll be with minus here, plus there'll be d mu squared sigma minus mh squared sigma equal to 0. So these two terms come from the ordinary thing. So then you see that in the infinite volume limit, where things are homogeneous, you can ignore, there is a consistent solution on which all the fields are constant. So then this term is 0, this term is 0. Then with necessity, B0 has to be non-zero, because I've got J0 put in. So B0 is related to J0 like that. And then if B0 is non-zero, then sigma also has to be non-zero, and also B0 has to be MH. Right. And this is a consistent solution of these equations.
So to what extent is this just telling me that if I have a bunch of positive charges, I never have the negative charges?
Right, so very good.
So
I'll have a whole section trying to explain this. What this is, whether this is an absolute minimum or whether this is a, so what it will end up being is a local minimum. This is only a local minimum. It's not the absolute minimum of the, but I'll come to that here. Okay, so then
You can imagine different evolution as well, right? Where in fact the tachyonic mass of the scalar could just disrupt the charge.
Tachyonic mass?
I'm guessing. I mean, you know, I think this is. I understand this is certainly one possibility, right?
But right.
If you start setting the system up and you're still not close to that solution someplace else,
right?
Then you just find the scalar has a tachyon mass.
Right.
And
we want to condense a bit.
That's one possibility,
right.
But could it just not destroy the fermionic distribution?
Yeah, absolutely. It could destroy fermionic distribution. In which case, you will end up in an ordinary phase in which these colors and fermions combine into amps.
Yeah.
And always there is that state which has something to do with this previous question. That state will be energetically more favorable.
Okay.
However, what I'm going to tell you in a few minutes is that if I prepare this state, then it has local minimum, so it's going to stay there for a long time. Right. So first of all, now one should check how this neutrality is enforced. It's not it's not obvious from the very beginning, or maybe I should explain that. So the neutrality is enforced in a simple way because the total charge density is a
Analytic method, but is there one over g in the formula for sigma or something?
No. Okay, so there is one. There is one over g for d zero,
right?
And this is without g. Okay, because you see, this I wrote this without g's because if I put g's here, there is g squared here, there is g here. And then there's g squared.
Okay, that's
yeah,
because
so
of how you normalize the current. Okay.
Yeah, let me. I'm gonna ignore g's because it's too hard to carry them around. But you can always restore them whenever you need. So there is no g here. All right. So what I was gonna say is that the total charge density is a combination of the two, the fermion charge density, and then you have scalar charge density. You can just calculate that what that is from the symmetries of the Lagrangian. And if you rewrite in this language, you will get that scalar charge density is just B0 sigma squared. In for more convenient field theory notation, this is just phi star covariant divided by phi star rewritten in these terms. So then you see that on this solution, these two terms exactly cancel because of that relation that is G, of course, here, which I promised you to ignore. So the inferior is neutral, completely neutral. Okay. So now, how about the boundary? Of course, this is a subtle problem. When you discuss into an infinite space, you should actually one should do is to regularize, because we're discussing the kind of in infinite volume space. This would be infinite amount of charge because the charge density is finite. Okay. So the correct way would be to regularize space where it's very large R, and then take the R goes to infinity limit. What you'll discover is that when you regularize,
wait, something you said just confused me. Right? I thought the level line has charge density, total charge density zero.
Who? Sorry? Who has?
That.
Okay,
so. That's a total charge density.
Very good, yes. This is total charge density. This
the
is total charge in the interior.
Now you're talking about the edge.
I'm talking about the edge now. Yes, precisely. Yes. And then.
Then you've got a regular. Then you've got
exactly.
Regular.
So then it's pretty clear from this, actually from this expression, that you have to have non-zero electric potential inside of some ball. So this is like an electrodynamics we saw for metallic ball, right? So what happens in metal, all these charges end up on the surface, and then they create non-zero constant potential in the interior. So that's precisely what happened here. In other words, if you start matching consistently the solution at the edge, you will end up having charge here, Q, which is related to that potential, again, up to this, up to the G and 4 pi's, as Q over R. Okay, that has to be the potential, and then you can calculate Q. So Q will be mH times R. So what that means is that there are two comments that I'd like to make here. So if I'm talking about this artificial infinite volume configuration, so that means that I have to have infinite amount of charge on the surface. However, its scaling is of course very different from the charges that are screened in the volume, because in the volume I fix the charge density so that the charge would grow like radius cubed, right? So in the surface it grows only linearly as R. So the dynamics is that this already suggested what will be happening when I look at the soliton, this type of soliton. Dynamics will be that the charges will be screened inside of the volume. However, there will be some small unscreened charge at the surface which will scale like this. And this is important. We will see this relation emerging from various points of view, various dynamical points of view. So far, this was just the artificial matching condition.
Why is this charge on the outside?
At the moment, I only discussed the very naive electrodynamics point of view, which is that if I want to have non-zero electric potential, somebody has to provide that. And my boundary condition, consistent boundary conditions are that they provide that. Now, in a few minutes, I'll show how that emerges dynamically. In other words, I'll put together you know, some NF number of fermions and NS number of scalars difference which between which is Q, and I minimize the functional of energy for that setup, and I will dynamically find that this is a true relation between the radius and the charge.
So you haven't really addressed stability in
any
marks yet. So I mean, the question is, of course, why this wouldn't just expand because of the
repulsion. I'm still here. I'm just trying to tell you, kind of to develop basic intuition of what this is and to try perturbations, and then I'll come.
Yeah.
So far,
in this case, everything is at infinity.
Exactly. Besides, or when I solve it for finite R, that means that I kept this size by hand or whatever other means,
right.
Like we do in electrodynamics for metallic sphere, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I was. So okay. So then I don't know if it makes much use, but you can also solve approximately for finite R, like you do in electrodynamics. The solution is something like this. This is sinh of R divided by delta cosine of R divided by delta plus C2 cosh of R divided by delta times sine of R divided by delta, okay, where C1 and C2 are proportional to something like e to the minus capital R divided by, so like this, where delta is the 1 over and NH1/2, and Mg is just coupling constant times the wave of sigma. Okay, so let me explain what this is. So this was the constant solution in infinite space. Okay, so now when you regularize with finite R, so you get corrections to it, which are very tiny in the interior. So all those corrections, because you see. These terms are suppressed by an exponent in which you have capital R being the size of this object, delta is the kind of width of the surface, which is related to the random expectation values of the scalar and the mass of the scalar. So also this regular, this finite when R goes to zero, because if this term is finite because of sinh, and this term is finite because of the sine. So those are the only two functions that will give you finite results.
So you're assuming that the fermion number density is non-zero even outside the object?
No. I'm assuming that there is a non-zero fermion number density inside the object, and there is nothing outside. So this is literally the electrodynamics problem. And even when I do that, what I get is that all the charges are screaming about, and all of them are on the surface. Okay. So now the spectrum. So again, I need all these properties because when I really go to real soliton, I have to answer questions, all sorts of questions like what are the small perturbations within the soliton, and how it's stable, and all that. So this gives you input to those properties. So.
Right. So I'm sorry. I just want to understand what you're doing. So I would think that J0, before J0 was fixed to be a constant and you solved for B0.
Right.
Right. But now if you're saying that J0 goes to zero outside, are you just fixing J0 and solving for B0, or are you solving some coupled equations?
Right. So I'm always solving these coupled equations. Always, no matter what case I discuss. Okay. So first solution that I gave you here was when this condensate was in infinite space, when I didn't have the edge at all. I just solved it for constant fields, right? So then I asked the next question. I mean, this doesn't really make much sense.
To solve an equation for J0. Right?
Sorry?
There's an equation for J0.
There is a fermion equation for J0, which is just ordinary free fermions. What I'm telling you is that there is a solution in which you have non-zero occupation number for fermions, because what happens is that D0 acts as a chemical potential for fermions. Okay? So these are fermions which fill up some Fermi surface. So that's a consistent solution. And then with that number density, which has a charge because I have effective chemical potential, I solve for B0, etc.
You get the shell because you have the
then you have gradients. Of course, yeah. So at the shell then you have gradients, yeah, of course, yeah. Right, so how about the perturbations? And that's possible to study. So you take the Lagrangian that I gave you and you expand, let's say B0 classical, so let's say B mu, the whole field is just, you know, B0 classical times delta mu 0 plus small perturbation depending on x, and same for sigma, let me call it tau. And let me summarize the results of the perturbations, and if somebody is interested, I can write down the Lagrangian for you, because they are slightly unusual. So we started with 2 degrees of freedom in the photon, and there were 2 degrees of freedom in the scalar field. So they are 4 together, ignoring fermions. Fermions are always there, their degrees of freedom don't change. Okay, so now these 2 and 2 redistribute into a massive photon. So there will be a massive photon. With mass, which I already introduced secretly. Like so. So it's obvious because this thing was vacuum expectation value of sigma, and the photon mass squared just coupling constant squared times the vacuum expectation value. And then there'll be a one massive scalar. With mass equals to 2 times NH. Okay? So this is important. So in this broken phase, let me call this phase a broken phase, because here, as you see, photon acquired mass. This is like a superconductor, okay? So U1 symmetry is spontaneously broken, photon is massive, and in the broken phase, the mass of the scalar is twice as large as the mass of the, you know, scalar outside of the, or in the true phase. There is a mass gap, okay? But that's not all, because these are very funny particles. In the following sense, so you would expect it, because you fix some fermion background that violates Lorentz invariance, obviously. I mean that sets the frame. So that violates Lorentz sets the frame, and because of that, propagation of perturbation around the frame should not be Lorentz invariant. And indeed, you will discover that when you do careful analysis, namely that. From that vector photon, 2 degrees of freedom, which are just ordinary transverse degrees of freedom of the massive photon, will propagate with the dispersion relation, which is just the usual one. Okay, so that's the 2 degrees of freedom of photon. For the 3 degrees of freedom, which is a longitudinal one, it will have very unusual dispersion relation. It's something like this, 2mh squared plus 1 half mg squared minus square root of 4 t squared mh squared 2mh squared minus 1 half of mg squared. 1 half. Okay? So it has propagation like this. Its mass is, of course, when you put p equals 0, you get precisely the mass, which is that. However, you can check that this never violates anything. I mean, it's always within the light cone, so this is always causal propagation. So there is no some there were wild things happening. There were tachyons or other instabilities here. And then what's left, of course, is that for the scalar, there is one degree of freedom, which has very similar dispersion relation with the plus sign here instead of the minus sign. Okay, so the net result is that you have these 4 degrees of freedom, which basically propagate with different group velocities, but all of them are subluminal, of course. Okay, so this goes to the question of when I come to the soliton, whether small perturbations here are stable or not. All of them are stable because this soliton inside will be very close to this infinite volume case that I'm discussing. Okay, because the size of the soliton is going to be much bigger than the width of the surface. Okay. So let me now go to the key issue, which is the issue of the dynamical stability of this object.
So can I far outside this object?
Far outside of
this. Does it have a net charge in the sense that it has an electric field?
Yes, the ordinary electric field of a spherical ball in electrodynamics.
And that charge is on the surface.
That sits on the surface, and there is nothing. And the profile of the other guy, sigma, is of course exponentially times pi scale mh.
So somehow coming back to the intuition, somehow the physical repulsion has a slower group velocity than the attractive stuff from this extra degree of freedom? Is that what is going to create the stability?
No, what was going to create stability, in short, I'll tell you now, because you're asking me already the second time, but is that there is no this size of the soliton is going to be greater than the quantum wavelength of the photon. So photon fits in, well fits in. So that means that there is no repulsion due to electromagnetism. Okay. However, there is a positive pressure because of the relativistic kinetic energy associated with certain terms in the Lagrangian. Okay, so that will be positive pressure. And then there is what compensates that is a negative pressure, which is created by the potential term or the mass term, like in inflation, for instance, right? If you have just m squared pi squared, so m squared pi squared gives you negative pressure. Here is very similar to that, although dynamics is slightly different. Mm-hmm. So that's a negative pressure, and these two compensate with each other. So so it lost the knowledge about electric repulsion because it screened the photon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's just, yeah.
So you're using gravity.
Okay,
the other way.
Right.
So instead of gravity holding a star together.
Well, so far, I have not included gravity. So when I include gravity, of course, I can have another mechanism of stabilization, which would be gravity against whatever wants this guy to expand. But that's a separate story.
I'll let you.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me describe in detail all that because. So of course, what we want to do is to write down the energy functional with fixed charge Q and fixed fermion number and a scalar number. All of those charges are fixed because they are conserved charges, and then extremize. So this is not extremization just of the energy functional; it's extremization under those conditions, under the constraints, okay, which is important. So now, the Hamiltonian density. I'll write this, but. I can derive if somebody asks me to. So Hamiltonian density, the most important terms are like this. Go like this. So schematically, this is what. So this it looks like usual fermion Hamiltonian, which is in this field B0, okay, and B0 creates the chemical potential, as I said, for them. So you have Fermi surface from here. And now there are two important terms which kind of stabilize the whole thing. This one is trivial. This is just the mass term for the scalar, and this is the one that will give you negative pressure. But then there is this term, which is what you get after you integrate out. You see, in the Lagrangian, the easy way to think about that term is this. So in the Lagrangian, there was a term which is b zero squared sigma squared, right? And then there is a term which is b zero times j zero. Okay. So if I integrate out b zero, what I'm gonna get is j zero squared divided by two sigma squared. This is just I resolve the in gauge theory, a zero, the zeroth component of the gauge field is not a dynamical variable, it has no time derivative. So I just integrated it out, and if I do that, then this is what I get. Okay, and this guy always provides positive pressure, because this is related to certain kinetic terms, or certain terms like this. Well, this guy provides negative pressure, so they'll be compensating each other. And of course, then there are terms which are square of the momenta for every single variable that I wrote, and then there are the gradient terms which are special derivatives. Okay. So now, let's now look at the possible object which is big, and by big I mean its size is greater than the photon quantum wavelengths. So in that case, as I'll show in a second, for large values of the total charge Q, what will be dominant destabilization is these two terms, not that term. Okay. Simply because, for instance, let's say fermions were relativistic, so then this term would be in energy, in terms of energy, this term would be n for first divided by r. But while these terms are proportional to Q, so I can always choose such a Q so that these are the dominant terms and not that one. And that condition implies that actually Q is greater than equal roughly than n fermion 1/3, which roughly equals to n scalar 1/3. Okay. So this is the number of fermions and scalars in the bulk, and if my charge is greater than 1/3 power of it, still being much smaller than the total number. So then the fermions do not play any role in stabilization. Okay. Now, so the next question one should ask is whether this surface charge plays any role, because this is a Q squared over R energy. It wants to dilute. It wants to dissipate. Okay. And the reason why it doesn't dissipate is rather interesting. So let me discuss that. So I said already that B0 is a non-dynamical variable, so it obeys ordinary Laplace equation. Laplacian of B0 equals to Q up to the sines and 4 pi and G, right? So that this is one of the equations that I get from my system. However, I treat it as a constant. This is Gauss's law. Okay? So so the Gauss's law I impose as a constraint on my variational problem, because I always have to maintain it. And according to the Gauss's law, B0 inside has to be Q divided by R. That's just a constraint. Okay, this is another way of Marcus understanding where this comes from. It is just the Gauss's law, consequence of it, the moment I say that there is a charge Q. Okay, so then the intuition is clear. So it's true that the surface charge Q squared over R charge wants to dilute the thing. Okay. However, while you're diluting the surface charge, you have to preserve the scalar number and the fermion number, which are related to each other. And for instance, the scalar number is like this. So this behavior implies very special dependence on R of the d cubed x sigma squared term. In particular, d cubed x sigma squared term has to grow with R in order to preserve the number of scalars and number of fermions. because this is a, again variation problem under the fixed Q. So and then it's very clear how this is giving you kind of force that wants to reduce the size, because you see I have to integrate this with respect to d cube x, and I just told you that d cube x times sigma square has to grow like r. So that energy wants to shrink the size, while this energy wants to grow the size. Okay. So in other words, the reason why this surface charge does not fly away is because it's connected to the volume densities. So you cannot change that shape without changing what's going on in the volume through this equation, because we have to preserve the number of particles. And then it's true that you would win in the surface energy, however you lose a lot in volume energy. So that's why this object is stable.
Of course, that assumes that these scalar particles can't escape, something like that. I mean,
you mean from the surface or from where?
Well, they can't just filter out of your classical of the situation you're setting up.
I mean, why? I just told you that there is a force that keeps them together. Why would they filter out? Well, there is that question, of course, from the surface, which I cannot.
They could migrate to the surface and the surface charge.
Exactly. There are two questions which I'll address. What you said from the surface going out, and then there is analog of Hawking radiation, which is PR creation. So I'll come to both.
Okay.
So far this is classical stability. So for qualitative discussions, let me just translate in terms of pictures so that it's more clear. So in the field space. Kind of, if you are doing the variations in the field space like we do in usual field theory, you have this type of potential. This is with respect to sigma, right? Because this term, this is a gradient term. It's small under this approximation. This term grows like this, while this term grows like that, and so you have a local minimum up until the point where gradients become important, and that's what gives you the original solution. If you just solve this potential, you get the solution that I discussed already. That's one point. Now, in terms of the R dependence, I can address another variational problem. Instead of variation with respect to fields, I can start varying with respect to size. Okay, and then if I do that. If I do that, then calculate energy. So this is what my energies will look like. Let's say I can have both relativistic and non-relativistic fermions. For simplicity, I'll do it for relativistic fermions, but that doesn't change anything. So the terms will look like this. Plus E surface, okay? So this is Q squared over R term of the surface dilution. This is the fermion degeneracy pressure, which also wants to dilute. But these are those two pressures, and especially this is the one that stabilizes. And you see that I can in the regime which I already mentioned, which is that Q is much greater than N one third, these terms are negligible. So whole stabilization takes place because of those two terms. Okay, and then they, of course their potential also looks like this. So there is a local minimum there.
So you're saying that the surface term is negligible for this sort of bulk stabilization, but don't you also have to look at the possible instability just from the sort of thickening of the surface? In other words, what, you know, the surface area, what prevents that from just becoming thicker and thicker?
Right. So what's this is like domain wall. You see the surface, because what happens is that I had this effective potential written there. It's like one over sigma square term and then sigma square term. Okay. So you can have domain wall type solution there, which gradient terms compensate the charge repulsion. That's what compensates is. But this won't compensate against the process in which you can just eject the charge. Okay, which I'll have to consider. You're talking about the classical widening, which is ensured by classical considerations. But there is a quantum process in which you can deplete the charge from the surface, which I need to address.
Just classically, though,
yeah.
You're saying that you don't have to. There's nothing to check.
No, there is something to check. There is what I'm saying is that there is a scalar nonlinear scalar potential, which is J0 squared sigma squared plus M squared sigma squared. Okay, and you should find the solution, or in other words, you should find the solution of this coupled problem, and we did that, and then you can check what's going on in that region. And what's going on in that region, there are repulsions, of course, which want to dilute that surface because you have Q squared over R energy stored in that surface. But then there are also gradient terms like a tension. You have other surface term, which is a tension. That wants to keep it together. there is, of course, something to check. That comes from the solution. But that's all classical. Okay, so then this was the effective potential in terms of R, and then when you stabilize, you will find this magic relation, which is that R critical is Q divided by MH. Okay, so this relation we previously we found just from the solution or from the matching the boundary conditions in which I assumed that it was stable, but here it comes out from the variational principle from stabilization of this.
So R critical means that bubble is bigger than that overall?
No, that means that if you prepare a bubble with fixed charge bigger than that, it will shrink, and if you prepare it smaller than that, it will expand, and they'll be stable here. Okay, so that's this stability with respect to collapse and decay. Now there are two other types of stability, which is with respect to evaporation classically and also quantum mechanically. And so one is this. So suppose we started with this Q guy. So why not favorable? So this was Q with some radius R. So why is not favorable energetically, for instance, for this guy to become Q minus R with some radius, which is let me call it R prime, and eject one particle. So this was all pluses, and eject one plus. That's the question. So actually we can calculate that what happens is that that's energetically not favorable as long as Q is much less than N two-thirds less than or equal. And the physical reason for that is this, that it's true that you would win in surface energy, but here you lose in the volume energy of the fermion degeneracy pressure. Okay? And this dominates over that wing as long as Q is less than N two-thirds. That's a simple exercise one can do. So in that respect, N one-thirds less than Q less than N two-thirds is stable with respect to those processes. And then there is an endless question, which is about the pair creation. So what could happen is that so you have now, close to the surface, you have huge electric fields because you have huge charge, and you can have Schwinger mechanism of pair creation, which is actually why black hole evaporates, but in gravitational sense, of course. And if pair creates, what will happen is actually it's interesting. So first of all, let me tell you that for certain Qs that doesn't happen simply because. Electric field is not strong enough for large Qs, because electric field is Q over R squared. So now let me substitute here the critical radius. So this is Q divided by Q squared divided by mh squared, and this is mh squared divided by Q. That's the electric field. And in order for the Schwinger process not to take place, I have to make sure that this is less than m electron squared divided by the alpha electromagnetic. And then there is a window for this Q in which that process doesn't take place. That window is very close when electrons are all just about relativistic, or when their number density 1 to the power is roughly the mass of the electrons. There is that window, so it doesn't take place. Okay. However, for then it's stable with respect to those processes. However, for the final phase, it's also nice to understand what happens when this process does take place, the Schwinger pair creation. And naively one would think this, that okay, so I create pair, so one of them gets ejected, let's say it goes here, and another one kills one of these charge, so it depletes this surface charge. But I just told you that process is not fair, here should emit the photon as well. Instead, of course, the pair creation takes place because this is a local process, but what happens is that discharge goes in. So you send in anti-particle, and you kill the particle inside. And so eventually you will end up with, maybe this was also what Marcus was asking, you will end up with pluses and minuses here, in which in the interior, for certain widths, you also produce excess of the positive charge because you annihilate some electrons inside. Okay. Now, I don't know if this object is stable, and most likely it won't be stable. So this is some kind of this different state from that. Okay, but this is the end result if the Schwinger process takes. I mean, this is end result as far as one can calculate, then probably it's unstable. But as I said, there is a region in which of Q's in which this is stable. Okay. So why this is interesting? Well, I think on theoretical ground, this is interesting because this is a new state of matter. So you can have helium and electrons with these densities, and this is a new state of matter like that. And in particular, it's known that, for instance, very heavy nuclei, they don't require, the question is, for instance, why don't very heavy nuclei exist, right? And the reason why is because when they have huge charge, greater than 137 or something, they do precisely the pair creation, and that's why they don't exist. So in order to avoid that, you have to make them bigger, but then nuclear forces cannot hold them together. So in a sense, what this does is that this is the big objects in which the charges are held together due to this positive and negative pressure balance, which has nothing to do with nuclear physics, of course. And this looks like a very big nucleus with some big charge, which wouldn't be allowed in ordinary atomic physics, of course. So of course there are a number of questions which go under this category that we have not addressed yet. In particular, what's the creation mechanism for these guys? So one possibility we're thinking about is after the nucleosynthesis, and of course before the recombination. So if there are certain anisotropies, so that these high densities, you have these high density anisotropies, then these high densities can kind of get locked in into this metastable state. And of course, at some point they will accrete electrons, and will end up being some big neutral objects. However, there will be very strong bounds on this just from the observations, because the moment they start accreting, they you have lots of energies, and that could screw up some other stuff. So I would expect there will be some strong bounds, which we still need to calculate. We haven't calculated. Okay. So one last point is that so far I haven't included gravity, but kind of if I was talking about particle size objects. For instance, if just to give you the feeling about the scale. So if I take millions.
So if I understand correctly, so if you basically make them big enough and fast enough, then you're saying they're actually absolutely stable, right?
Thanks for that question, because I didn't discuss that point, which is that classically they are stable.
Yes.
But they can tunnel quasi classically.
Uh-huh.
they can tunnel quasi classically, and if you estimate the tunneling rate, it's it goes like this. This exponent minus some number, this n to the 4/3. Okay? So for large n, this is very suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very long lived. Yeah, there will be Casimir force, but because these are big objects, those are small contributions. So they will even be smaller than the fermion degeneracy pressure that I was discussing, which is subdominant to the effects that stabilize this object.
Is this correct that it's you can make it for any n as long as you then charge it?
Exactly. You can make it for any n as long as charge satisfies these properties. Yes, precisely.
So if I try to imagine this object, I've got these massive things, and they have charges. I mean, I would think that what they would really want to do is that they would want to form, you know, onion type atoms. You know, they would be positive or negative guys would want to form, and the size of those things is those things are pretty small. So that the scale for those things is just 1 over alpha times 1 over m. So it's, you know, it's only a factor of alpha different from their Compton radii, right? So I'm just wondering, and just in terms of actually producing this object right here, you're going to have to break a lot of these sort of atomic bonds.
No. So you see, I'm thinking of high temperature where atoms are not formed yet. This is between nucleosynthesis and recombination. So temperature is high enough so that atoms don't form, ordinary atoms, right? However, it's still low enough for these type of guys to form because you can do that calculation. Okay. So then these guys form first.
At those high temperatures, isn't somehow the electromagnetic field that
that's the point. You see, as long as, of course, there is some screening, there is a plasma frequency, etc. But as long as temperature is less than certain critical value, which for this example that I'm giving you is like 10 kV or something.
So it has to be less than the binding energy, or greater than the binding energy of these objects, which is alpha squared m.
No, it has to be less than binding energy, otherwise it will destroy, right?
I thought you wanted to have large enough temperature to avoid these atoms from forming.
Well,
These are different atoms. So
I mean, atoms made out of your positive and negative things. I mean, I'm just giving you your elementary positive and negative things. I don't care what they're made out of.
Right.
But I'm just saying they will want to form.
Sure. Let me tell you this.
Essentially, it's like this, which is entropy.
Let me answer to this question on the concrete example. Okay, so let's take this helium and electrons. This is a concrete example which we believe in the universe took place. So then here is a temperature going down. This is opposite. So here you have VVN roughly, right? And here you have temperature of the recombination. So below. And these are decreasing temperatures, okay? Decreasing temperatures. So below this temperature, atoms form, okay? Above, atoms of ordinary hydrogen for protons and electrons combined, as well as the heliums and all the light nuclei that form the atoms, right? So above this temperature, everything is ionized. In other words, you have protons. You have neutrons and you have helium nuclei, okay? Helium nuclei and electrons, of course.
I see this is different. If you only have positively charged scalars and negatively charged electrons, for example, then the size of these bound states will be set by the lightest guy.
Exactly. So let me answer your question in this context, and we'll go to that context. So clearly. Once you form, first of all, you form this heavy object, which is still charged, but now that heavy object can accrete electrons and form this new superatom in a sense, right? Simply because it's binding energy much greater than the binding energy of the hydrogen, because it's got huge Z. This is like huge nucleus, right? So you can still form those guys here. This is what you were saying, but of course you were saying this in terms of two guys which have positive charge and negative charge. Of course, if you have that kind of situation, you have to calculate what the binding energy is. It's a reduced mass times alpha squared, right? And as long as that is greater than the temperature, then you form that. If not, then you don't. So, in general context. But here you would form these arms. I was gonna give you just.
Look at this thing and something. Poof! It starts emitting a shower of positive.
Yeah, actually, it's very interesting. I don't know how much time I have. Can I answer this question still, or in detail, or? Maybe I'll take five.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, yes.
Why don't you reach a spot where the people who are less
Okay, fine, sure.
Get the punchline, and then we go take time.
Okay, great. Yeah. That's a very interesting point. So I was just gonna give you the order of magnitude. So if n is 10^6, and then q is something like 10^3 or something, so you can have the size of this guy, which I, as I remember, was 10^3 Fermi, and this width, which is 10 Fermi. Okay. So this is delta. This width. And this is the this R is size, so it's still much smaller than an atom, and its surface area is very small, and it's got huge charge, of course. So it can form heavy atoms or something like that. That's just one example. Now the gravity, very very quickly, just to finish this story. So if I switch on gravity, so then you could make, of course, the very big ones, because in that case this is no different from the stabilization of neutron stars, in the sense that you have fermion degeneracy pressure, and you have these terms that we have, but for big objects they can be negligible, and then there is the gravitational force. So in ordinary neutron stars, what compensates, what stabilizes this is this versus this. Okay? Because you created so many ends that these are subdominant. So you can have neutron star type objects just made of this type of matter. And then there is maybe one possibility for new type of objects, which I don't know, again, we haven't explored it enough, in which this term is also participating in kind of reducing the effects of gravity, because you see this field is 1 over r, but it is repulsive, as opposed to gravity, which is attractive. So there could be some region in which this compensates well enough. So there is like interplay between gravity and this condensation phase that I was discussing, which could give rise to some new type objects, but we haven't studied it carefully enough to make any statements about this. Okay, just to summarize, so here there is this possibility to have in a very simple system, there is no kind of nonlinear potential for the star itself, to have these quasi-stable objects. Of course, if I had some additional nonlinear potentials, then I could create cubo-type objects, which are well-known. But those objects are all due to this nonlinear scalar potential, which is rather kind of special. And clearly, it doesn't apply to this helium case that I was discussing, because helium doesn't have that potential. So in this case, you can have that objects. And of course, the issue of production and the presence of cosmology, what balanced cosmology and poisson, they are still open and under the study, so I hope we will converge on the issue very soon. So I'll stop here and then answer questions. Yeah, next question. So that's very interesting. So what is the instability of this, right? So what can happen is that the size of this guy is such that interparticle separation is smaller than the atomic scale. Mm-hmm. Now, if